So we continue in the book of Job, and if you were here last week, then you'll know that we begun looking at the dialogues. That's chapters 3 through to 27. The dialogues then Job has with himself and these three friends who came to comfort him in his afflictions. And last week then we looked at what the friends had to say as they came to try to comfort him in his afflictions. And this week then we will focus on Job and his speeches in response to his friends. Now last week then we found then that looking at the speeches of the friends was at one level very straightforward, because they essentially have only one point to make. They beat the same notes again and again. Their only message that they have to convey to Job is that he has sinned greatly, and that is why he's suffering as greatly as he has. That therefore all he has to do is to acknowledge his sins and to seek then restoration from the Lord. And they make that point again and again. And as I said, the brilliance of the poetry that the prophet uses kind of helps us not perhaps get bored with this one message that they keep repeating. We also saw, of course, their utter failure as comforters for Job. They failed to pray. They failed, in fact, to offer a single word of comfort to him. That, in fact, they made his afflictions worse. But then, as I say, at one level, at least their message was straightforward. They just had this one thing to say. But when we come to Job's speeches, it's a lot more difficult, isn't it? It's difficult for several reasons. First of all, we saw that the friends, one of their failures was that they never speak to the Lord. They never prayed. They never saw any need as comforters to call upon God. But Job, time and again, of course, does. He calls upon the Lord. So sometimes he's speaking directly to God. Sometimes he's addressing his friends. And then at other times, we don't really know, he seems to be soliloquizing. That is, he is airing his thoughts out loud without, it seems, addressing God specifically or his friends specifically. He is just thinking out loud, airing his perplexity at his situation. And sometimes then we can be sure he's speaking to God. Sometimes we can be sure he's speaking to his friends. Sometimes it just isn't clear. Now, ultimately, of course, the Lord hears everything he says, and the friends hear everything that he says. But he changes then who he's addressing. And also then he varies in the way in which he speaks. He uses different types of rhetoric. And he varies in the content of what he says. He says different things to his friends from what he says to the Lord. And he switches then between them, so it's difficult to follow. And I'm not going to attempt then to untease all this complexity this evening. I want to just attempt to give us an overview of the main themes as to what is going on in these chapters. So first of all then, looking at Job's interaction then with these three friends. And considering first of all the way in which he speaks to them, the manner of his speeches to his friends. So sometimes, as in chapter 9, at least as he begins his speech there, he's reasonably measured and controlled. He produces a reasonably measured and controlled argument. At other times, he is in deep despair, isn't he? Chapter 3, as he begins these dialogues, he erupts then with a lament, which is just a great cry of pain and agony, put into beautiful poetry, but it reflects then the depths of his distress, this lament. Or in chapter 6, in his despair, he says, "Oh, that my vexation were weighed and my calamity laid in the balances. Then it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words have been rash, for the arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit drinks their poison." He feels poisoned arrows from God in him, weighed down by this immensity of sands that were squashing him and crushing him. He feels without taste and hunger. He says, "Does the wild donkey bray when he has grass, or the ox low over his fodder? Can that which is tasteless be eaten without salt, or is there any taste in the juice of the mallow?" He's in despair. He is cast low. But other times he is more energized. Other times he has much more vehemence in his interaction. So he rebukes them and corrects them, doesn't he? He says in chapter 13, verse 4, "As for you, you whitewash with lies. You're all worthless physicians." So he brings these rebukes, or again in chapter 16, "I've heard many things from you all. You're miserable comforters, all of you. What windy words you have. What provoked you that you answer?" So he rebukes them in these ways. At other times, he, in different rhetoric, he uses irony. So chapter 7 is a chapter where he uses a whole section that is irony, particularly clearly from chapter 27, verses 13, to the end in chapter 23, where he repeats essentially the argument that the friends use. So he takes up, as it were, their words that they've been saying to him, "Job, you're a wicked man, and we know what happens to the wicked. They all get punished. You're all being punished, therefore you must be wicked." So he says in chapter 27, "Well, this is the portion of a wicked man with God and the heritage that oppressors receive from the Almighty. If his children are multiplied, it's for the sword. If his descendants have enough bread, well, those who survive the pestilence will bury them, and his widows don't weep." And so he carries on using exactly the same kind of words that his friends have used against him. And actually, just because Job uses this argument, a lot of the commentators say, well, of course, what we have here is a problem in the text. That although at the beginning of chapter 27 we have Job took up his discourse and said, they say, well, this is obviously a mistake in the text. Clearly, this must be one of the friends speaking here, because he's using all the arguments that Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar have used in all the preceding chapters. But that's a fundamental misread. He's just simply using irony. He's heard their arguments, and he said earlier, "I could speak like you," and he's just saying, "All right, it's like this." He's using irony. And of course, one of the problems when you use irony as a form of rhetoric is that, like I think the prophet here with these commentators, you can get misinterpreted. There's a classic historical, well, it's happened often in history, but there was the classic case of Daniel Defoe with his famous tract, "The Shortest Way with Dissenters." So Daniel Defoe, of course, more well known for his novels, but he was a dissenter, and he produced this tract. And he produced it anonymously. Now, as a dissenter, he produced this tract saying, speaking exactly the same sort of things that Anglican bishops and other clerics had used to say, "We ought to persecute these dissenters more harshly. We're being too soft with them." So he wrote this tract saying, "We're being too soft with them, merely throwing them into prison and depriving them of their liberty and so on. We really ought to get to grips with them and start killing these people off," and this sort of thing. And this tract then was taken up by bishops and so on and waved and said, "This is fantastic. This is the kind of thing we ought to do." Until they found out it was Daniel Defoe who had written this tract, and they'd completely misread the irony of the way then he was undermining all their arguments. Well, Job then is using irony to try to undermine the arguments of his friends in chapter 27. He also uses the more blunt method of sarcasm, doesn't he? So back in chapter 12 and verse 2, he says to his friends in response to one of their arguments, "Well, you know, no doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you." Just plain sarcasm. Or in chapter 26 and verses 2 and 3, again, as he begins there, a response to them and then quickly gives up on them, he says, "How you've helped him who has no power. How you've saved the arm of him that has no strength. How you've counseled him who has no wisdom and plentifully declared sound knowledge." Again, he's just being sarcastic. At other times, relatedly, he just mocks them. In chapter 13 and verse 5, he says, "Oh, that you would keep silent. That would be your wisdom." And verse 12, "Your maxims, they're proverbs of ashes. Your defences are defences of clay." So Job uses then, sometimes powered by his emotion, he's in despair and distress, but other times he uses this rhetoric to counter the arguments of his friends. He uses irony, which is very powerful, can be very powerful to undermine their arguments, as we've seen. He uses sarcasm. He uses blunt mockery to take on the arguments of these friends. And of course, the reason partly he takes up these is because they're not listening to him. They're not listening. They just keep telling him again and again, Job, you're a great sinner. That's why you're suffering, and so on. And so to try to get through to these people who simply won't listen and ignore his arguments, he uses these different rhetorical methods of sarcasm, irony, and so on. And I think it's just, we remember then that at the end of the book, the Lord says that Job has spoken rightly, and that then the methods then that Job uses here of sarcasm, of irony, of mockery, that these things are perfectly legitimate ways of speaking. That sometimes we can have perhaps a view of Christian piety that is very soft, if you like. A kind of wimpy view of Christian piety that says, you know, a Christian would never speak with any vehemence. A Christian wouldn't use rhetoric like this to mock someone else. That if a Christian was sarcastic in engaging with other people, and somehow that's not right behaviour for a Christian man or woman. And that's not so, is it? I mean, it's not only from what we read here in Job, who the Lord is perfectly willing to accept this as rhetoric that Job speaks. We have it very clearly in some of Paul's letters, don't we? Particularly 2 Corinthians, other Corinthians, 1 Corinthians and Galatians, where he uses this kind of rhetoric, angry words, sarcastic and ironic words, in his engagement there with opponents who are not going to listen to him. So there's nothing wrong, it can be perfectly legitimate in dealing with such people to use these kinds of way. It's not wrong for a Christian to do so. So Job then uses these different modes of rhetoric, reflecting at times then his emotional state. And in terms of what he actually says when he deals with his friend, he's really just got a couple of things to say. Firstly, as we saw, touched on last week, he rebukes them for their hard-heartedness. He rebukes them for their hard-heartedness. We saw that last week at the beginning of chapter 16 in verses 4 and 5 where he says, you know, if I were in your place, yeah, I could use these arguments, he says, that you're using. I know why you're using them. I could join my words together and shake my head at you, but I would strengthen you. I would help you and fortify you with my mouth and the solace, the comfort my lips. That would assuage you. That would help you. Or again, in chapter 6, we have the poignant words later in the chapter, where he says, you would even cast lots over the fatherless. That's your attitude. That's how hard you're being with me. Where's your compassion? Now be pleased. Look at me. I will not lie to your face. They can't even look him in the eyes. They can't even look at his face as they engage with him. He's saying, how are you going to comfort me? How are you going to bring compassion to me if you can't even look me in the eyes? If I were in your place, I would do that. So he criticizes them for a fundamental lack of compassion. He says in chapter 19 and verse 21, oh, have mercy on me. Have mercy on me, you, my friend. For the hand of God has touched me. In his afflictions, he doesn't feel comfort from these men who've come to comfort them. And then secondly, he denies, of course, their arguments, their fundamental theodicy, as it's sometimes called, that is their argument that Job is suffering because he's done wickedly. Their view is the way that God governs the world is, then that wickedness always leads to suffering, and vice versa. So suffering is a result always of wickedness. It's a simple world from their point of view that the Lord runs. But of course, Job points out at different points, but most clearly in chapter 21, he says, well, actually, this isn't true, is it? He says, it isn't true. Look at the world we actually live in, not your theoretical world. So we read chapter 21. I'll just a few parts from it. He says then in 21 verse 7, why do the wicked live and reach old age and grow mighty in power? Their offspring are established in their presence and their descendants before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear and no rod of God is upon them. Their bull breeds without fail. Their cow calves and doesn't miscarry. They send out the little boys like a flock. Their children dance. They sing to the tambourine and to the lyre and rejoice to the sound of their pipe. They spend their days in prosperity. And so on. He says, it just isn't true. There are plenty of wicked people out there who do very well. Open your eyes and look. You're wrong. Your arguments are false. So he corrects them then for their false arguments. As I've seen, having he does that, but he also is kind of gives up on them because he mocks them and is sarcastic with them because they simply won't listen. They won't look at the facts of the real world in which they're living. So Job's dealing with his friends then. But secondly, and at more length, and I think more importantly, his dealings were his speeches to the Lord. Now, in his speeches to the Lord, which are the dominant material in these chapters, then we feel then Job's sufferings, don't we? We've read a lot of that in chapters 9 and 10. Job, of course, in speaking to the Lord, doesn't use sarcasm or irony. He doesn't speak like this to the Lord. But he does speak with immense sadness and despair. I don't think he has clinical depression. I think he is simply responding to terrible circumstances that the Lord has brought upon him. But he does speak then as a man in despair. He says in chapter 14, "Man who is born of women is a few days and full of trouble. He comes out like a flower and withers. He flees like a shadow and then continues not." Or as we read back in chapter 9, from verse 25, "My days are swifter than a runner. They flee away, they see no good. They go by like skiffs of reed, like an eagle swooping on the prey, his days flying by as they do when you're low and sad. If I say I'll forget my complaint, I'll put off my sad face and put on a cheerful one," he says. Because he is sad, he's in despair because of his suffering. So Job is in despair, he's sad. And at times then this erupts in anger, what appear to be angry words towards the Lord. Of course, it's difficult to be sure reading the text exactly what his emotional state is sometimes. But at the beginning of chapter 10, he says, "I loathe my life. I will give free utterance to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me," and so on. So he's speaking, as he himself says, in bitterness. He's a man here who is more energized than somebody who's depressed. He is in despair, but he's got energy to cry out to the Lord in his despair, to express angry words at what is happening to him, to the Lord, to speak, as he says, in bitterness of soul. And as you know, if you read through these chapters, you will find these kinds of expressions elsewhere in Job's speeches, particularly then in his speeches to the Lord. And it teaches, as I've said before, and we have this in the Psalms as well, don't we, that there is that there is an honesty, a straightness in what Job says. He is suffering horrendously. He's had these multiple bereavements. He's lost all his wealth. He's a pariah now, when once he was esteemed in society. And he's got this horrific skin disease from which he thinks he's dying. He doesn't think he's only got a few days to live, he says. So this is his suffering. And so he expresses himself in accordance with this. And I'm saying, as I said before, there is nothing wrong in praying like this. Because, of course, to pretend that everything is hunky-dory in coming to the Lord in prayer, when in fact you're feeling terrible, like Job does, would just be foolish, because the Lord knows, and a kind of dishonesty in our approach to God. Job comes in and expresses the depth of his feelings. He articulates them in a way that we would struggle to do, but nonetheless, the point is that he speaks then with honesty to the Lord. An honesty that is in proportion to and accordance with the depth of his suffering. But as I said before, might be shocking to us. But when we go through times of distress and trouble, then we have the confidence from this, from the way David often speaks in the Psalms, in his afflictions. But we have a Lord whom we can speak to like this. But the Lord does accept Job's speech like this. There's nothing wrong in crying out to the Lord with this kind of pain and expressing the pain that we feel. But what does Job say to God? What's the content of his speech to the Lord? Well, essentially he makes three main points to God. First of all, of course, he asserts his innocence, doesn't he? We read that several times in chapter 9 and 10 in his speech there. To verse 21, he says, I am blameless. In chapter 10 and verses 5 to 7, he says, are your days as the days of man? Or your years as man's years, that you seek out my iniquity and search out my sin? Although you, Lord, you know that I'm not guilty. You know that I am not guilty. And in chapter 27, and verses 2 to 5, he again expresses this very clearly. He says, as God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils, my lips will not speak falsehood. My tongue will not utter deceit. Far be it from me to say that you, friends, are in the right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days. So Job asserts very clearly again his innocence. Satan, remember, has said, he's bound to curse you, Lord. He's bound to speak badly when he suffers. And Job says, I will not speak falsehood. I will not utter deceit. I will maintain my integrity. And so Job, first of all, to the Lord, to the friends, in his soliloquies, he asserts his innocence. And secondly, he of course asserts that what he is suffering is from the hand of God. And we've seen in the readings we've had tonight and earlier, the very straight way, at times very blunt way, in which Job makes such assertions. So in chapter 16, and from verse 11, Job then says of the Lord, speaking of God, I was at ease, and he, God, broke me apart. He seized me by the neck and dashed me to pieces. He set up me as his target. His archers surround me. He slashes open my kidneys and does not spare. He pours out my gore on the ground. He breaks upon me breach upon breach. Or similarly, in chapter 19 and verses 6 to 10, know then that God has put me in the wrong and closed his net about me. Behold, I cry out violence, but I am not answered. I call for help, but there is no justice. He, God, has walled up my ways that I cannot pass. He has set darkness upon my paths. He has stripped from me my glory and taken the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side, and I am gone. And so on. Very clearly then, asserting that God has so afflicted him. And we considered this a little in the opening sermon. And of course, the point is that Job is correct in both of these assertions, isn't it? If we didn't have chapters 1 and 2, we would perhaps very much doubt what Job says. But we have the prologue and we have the epilogue. And the prologue asserts very clearly, of course, Job's innocence. That is, not that he's sinless, as I said before, but that the reason he is suffering is not because he's done anything to deserve it. Quite the opposite. So when Job asserts his integrity, his righteousness, his innocence and so on, he's absolutely right. And secondly, of course, he's absolutely right that the Lord has brought it upon him. Job isn't willing to adopt any view of the universe that would put events outside the power and the will of God. He has a very high view of the sovereign rule of God. He knows that these things must have come from the hand of God. And again, of course, we know from the prologue that this is spelled out from us explicitly. This is the case. The Lord has allowed Satan to go and bring all these things upon him. It is then from the hand of God. Job is absolutely correct in asserting his innocence, and he's absolutely correct in asserting that his suffering, horrendous as it is, has come from God's own hand. But perhaps the most surprising thing is the conclusion Job now draws from these two truths. Because the conclusion he draws is that he needs to sue God in court. That the only way out is to take God to court. You see, Job knows that if he had suffered at the hands of another man, another human being, he knows what he would do. If, as an innocent man who hadn't done anything wrong, somebody had come along and beaten him up, he knows what he would do. He would take him to court. He would sue him and say, you afflicted me in this way and I hadn't done anything to deserve it. There were no legitimate grounds for you afflicting me in this way. So he would take him to court. And in that period, that meant often going to the city gate. City for us probably being a village or a town, but a place where you would take disputes. So we have that, of course, in the book of Ruth, for example, where Boaz goes to debate and argue with a kinsman there about the inheritance of Ruth and who should own that and so on. That's where the place where these legal disputes were sorted out. It was a place where there were no lawyers. There were no barristers then. You argued it face to face with your opponent before the elders or judges or judge. That's how their legal system worked. You remember Solomon as judge on the throne and the two women then coming to argue their case before him about the baby, the newborn baby who had died. It's the two women who argue face to face. There's no lawyers involved. They have to argue their case before the judge who then gives his verdict. So this is the context. So Job thinks, well now, if a man had done me wrong, if as an innocent I had been badly treated by another human being, I know what I would do. I would take them to court. And so what we have is Job thinking through this dilemma. He's saying to himself sometimes explicitly, well, if it were a man, I know what I would do. But it isn't a man, it's God. How can I take God to court? How can I sue God in a lawsuit? Now we know that this is what's going on because there's some of the words that are used in the original. So there's a key word, read, that's used in several times through Job's speeches. It's a word that's translated in English normally something here like dispute or contend or argue. And those translations are okay. The problem is they don't capture the legal connotations that are so important. The Hebrew word read means, to quote the kind of dictionaries, means lawsuit, legal dispute, to enter into litigation, to dispute in a court of law. It's a bit like a word like subpoena. You know, if you said I was going to subpoena someone, you would know that you were speaking about law, about taking somebody to a law court. And there are other legal words that are used in the language of Job in his dispute with God. That makes it very clear then that what he's doing is thinking through this. I need to take God to court. I need to take my dispute to a law court. I need to demand that God comes and meets with me in court so that I can argue my innocence and have myself vindicated before men. Here I am suffering unfairly. Everybody thinks I'm a bad man and a sinner. I need to be vindicated. How can I be vindicated when the Lord has done it to me? So the essence then of the argument that runs through Job's speeches is Job, in his distress, in all his confusion, all his perplexity, thinking through, how can I do this? So we read then in chapter 9, we read then this language in verse 3. If one wished to contend, to enter into this legal suit, lawsuit with the Lord, chapter 9, verse 3, you know, he says, how can I do it? How can a man be right before God? He's mighty. He's so wise. So chapter 9 is this lovely poetry reflecting on Job saying, how can I do this? How can I sue God in court? How can I argue and out-argue and win a case by arguing against God, who is mighty and wise and knows all things, he would just overwhelm me with his arguments. Even though I know I'm right, I'd end up in the wrong if I try to argue a case with the Lord in this way. How can then I dispute with him? And towards the end of the chapter then, as he's concluding this, he says, he's not a man that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together. If it were a human being, yeah, I could do this and it would be okay. I could make my case, but he's not a man. And he says in verse 33, there's no arbiter between us, no mediator, no one to come between me and the Lord and help me, no one who might lay his hand on us both to take away God's rod from me, so he didn't overwhelm me and terrify me, so that I would be able to speak and articulate my arguments to him. He says, so I would speak without fear of him. My situation, he goes on to say, is utterly hopeless. And then in his next speech in chapters 13 and 14, he again then takes up this legal dispute. So again, in verse 3, we have this language. I would speak to the Almighty. I would desire to argue my case with God. I want to argue my case with the Lord. That is, I want to take God to court and argue my case with him there. And later on from verse 16, again, we have this language. He says, look, Lord, keep listening to my words. Let my declaration be in your ears. I prepared my case and I know I'll be in the right. Who's going to argue against me? Who's going to contend with me? And so on. So he's making these legal arguments. He's making his arguments in his dispute with the Lord. He's hypothesizing what he would do if God came and he's going to argue with him. And he warns his friends in verses 7 and 8. Because these friends are putting themselves forward as witnesses as who he would say is to the fact. They're saying, we know what's going on here. And so Job says in verses 7 and 8, would you speak falsely for God and speak deceitfully for him? Will you show partiality towards him? Will you plead the case for God? If it comes to a lawsuit, are you going to stand up then and lie on behalf of God? Because I'm innocent and you're speaking wrongly. You're in a dangerous position, my friend. And chapter 16, again, in his next speech, Job again comes round to this theme of his arguments in more well-known words. And here he, as I've said, he thinks he's dying. He's been speaking of his ill health. He feels he's not got long to live then. So he says in verse 18, O earth, cover not my blood, and let my cry find no resting place. Now this is the biblical language of the blood uncovered, most famously, of course, with Cain and Abel. So the blood crying out from the ground. Here is an innocent man who has been killed, Abel. His blood cries out for justice to God. So Job is taking up this language and saying, if I die as an innocent man, I'll be an innocent man who's been killed. So I want my blood to cry out for justice. And it says, even now, behold my witness, I have a witness, I have a testimony in heaven. And he who awaits me, it's not really human that he's speaking of clearly here. The testimony, the witness here is a thing. It's his legal argument. It's a dispute that he has made. The arguments he has brought and brought together. He's saying, if I die, I want my blood to cry out. And I've written down, as it were, these things. I've made my case. And this testimony, this argument I've made, this is going to remain and speak for me, even if I die. My friends scorn me, my eye pours out tears to God. He says that this testimony then would argue on behalf of me before God, as a man or a son of man does with his neighbour. So he's looking to his testimony, his argument, to cry out on his behalf. And then most famously in chapter 19 and verses 23 to 27. Again, then in verse 23, he's saying, my arguments, my testimony, I want them written down in verse 23, that my words were written, that they were inscribed in a book. that they were written with an iron pen and lead, that they were engraved then in rock forever. He wants his arguments, the case he has made, to be everlasting, like his blood crying out if he dies innocently. He wants his testimony to remain to vindicate him someday on earth. Now I come to verse 25 in chapter 19 at an ironic time of year, coming up to Christmas, and to say that, of course, the prophet, I think, intended something different in these words than Handel, and that Redeemer with a capital R, as in the English translations, is not right. That this book then, when we read Redeemer, of course, as Christians, we think of redemption from sin, don't we? And when it's got a capital R, of course, it's meant to make us think of Christ, our Redeemer, from sin. But this book has nothing to do with redemption from sin. This book is nothing about redeeming man from sin. As we've seen, read the book, there's nothing in it on this theme at all. So for this suddenly to make a statement about Christ's redemption would be completely out of context. Now the word here in Hebrew, goel, is the same word as used in Ruth and so on for the kinsman redeemer. And can just be kinsman, the idea then of your kinsman who will act on your behalf in some kind of legal dispute. So you remember, you know, Ruth wanted a kinsman, someone who's going to act on her behalf. So the kinsman is a relative. If we have to have an R here, it shouldn't be redeemer, it should be relative. She wants a relative. So Job is saying, I want a relative, a kinsman, who would help me. Remember, Job doesn't have a kinsman to help him, does he? His children have been killed. His brothers and sisters, whom we read of at the end, have totally abandoned him. And his wife, with the less said about Job's wife, the better. He hasn't got someone to help him, a kinsman to help him. So in his dispute with the Lord, what he wants then is a kinsman to help him in his dispute. So that one day, at the end, he will be vindicated. He might die first, and his blood cry out, and the arguments he made need to carry on crying and speaking to the Lord. They're written down and engraved on stone. He may need a kinsman to help him. But after his flesh has been destroyed, he's confident he will be vindicated as an innocent man, and yes, he will see God. But what he wants is vindication on earth. He wants vindication, his innocence to be declared on earth. So this continues then, this theme of Job's legal dispute with God. And in chapter 23 then, he brings this, for these chapters at least, to a conclusion. In chapter 23, where he finally takes up again his desire to be vindicated on earth. So he says in verse 3 of chapter 23, oh, that I knew where I might find him, that is the Lord, that I might come to his seat. I would lay my case before him, before the Lord, where if he could find him, and fill my mouth with arguments. I know that he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Would he contend with me in the greatness of his power? No. He would pay attention. He would listen to me. There I could argue with him, and I would be acquitted forever by my judge. So Job at this point has some confidence that he is going to be vindicated. He is finally going to be acquitted. He's been calling on the Lord, demanding that the Lord come. He's trying to subpoena him to get him to dispute in court. He's saying, I wish I could find where God is, that I could go and argue with him, but I don't know where he is. And he goes on to say, I don't know where he is. If I go forward, he's not there, and backward, he's not there, and so on. He says, I want to search for God. I want to make my case, because I'm confident that God is just, and he will vindicate me. And so he says, you know, he knows the way that I take, and when he has tried me, I shall come out as gold. I am going to be vindicated. I am going to come out as gold in the end. So as he brings these arguments to a conclusion, at least in these dialogues, then he's saying, yes, somewhere the Lord is going to vindicate me. I'm confident this must happen because I know that I am innocent. And we know what happens, don't we? The Lord does come to dispute with God. It's what we read of in chapter 38 and so on, isn't it? The Lord uses the same language as the legal dispute, and he says to Job, you wanted to enter into a lawsuit with me, Job? Well, come on then, let's argue. I'm going to ask you some questions, Job, and see if you can answer them. And we'll consider that, of course, God willing, later in this series. But my point is simply, Job demands that his day in court with God, and God comes to him to give him his day in court, to dispute with him. And ultimately, of course, the Lord vindicates him, doesn't he? He's demanded that God comes to him, and he does. And he's demanded that the Lord vindicates him, and he does, as we read in the epilogue. He declares Job publicly before his friend as righteous, and he restores him to all his wealth and status in society. So he's publicly vindicated and declared innocent as he had desired. So it's a book with a happy ending after all the horrible sufferings of Job, all this confusion he goes through. It has this wonderful conclusion where Job is vindicated. So I said that in our distress we can cry honestly to the Lord in imitation of Job and so on. But of course, we have one huge advantage over Job, don't we? Several of you have probably been sitting there thinking, Alan's missing all these kind of messianic themes or sections in this book. Well, Redeemer as Redeemer isn't messianic in that way. It's not about redemption from sin. But he does want a kinsman to help him. He does want someone, as he says earlier, to arbitrate for him between him and God. He contemplates, how can I come before the Lord and have those mighty uncreated beams hit me, as it were? How can I dispute with God? I need an arbitrator. I need someone to come between us. As he uses the language of his witness in heaven, yes, I'm arguing that what Job meant originally was his evidence that he wants to deposit, his legal evidence. But the language is ambiguous and surely does point to more than inanimate evidence, more than legal argument. In the context of this language, particularly of kinsman and arbitrator, then he's looking to someone who will make his case, someone who will help him in his arguments with God. Arguments, remember, that are not about sin and so on. They're about his confusion and his suffering. This is about, how do I pray when I'm in agony and I can hardly articulate my words? How do I pray when I don't know why God is doing this to me? How do I come before God and speak to him when he has treated me in this way? And we know then that we have someone that Job didn't have or didn't have knowledge of to help him. We have a mediator. We have someone who can arbitrate on our behalf, who can help us before the throne in heaven, and whose spirit, as the counsellor or the advocate whom he sent to us, can help us articulate our arguments here on earth. They might be groans that make no sense to us, but the Lord can take those through Jesus Christ by the Spirit and transform them into arguments that articulate those heartfelt groans before the throne in heaven. Job didn't know of this. We have this immense blessing, don't we? We might not suffer like Job. We will suffer in different ways. But as we do, let us be people who cry to the Lord as he cried. Cry from the heart. And when we struggle in prayer, when we struggle to articulate, when we feel perhaps, how can we come and say these things to the Lord? Let us come then through Jesus Christ, knowing that we have this one whom Job didn't have, to argue our case in heaven. Amen. So we sing then finally from a hymn on the overhead projector, a hymn I wanted to sing about a month ago, but we didn't have the apparatus working. So John Ryland's hymn, Sovereign Ruler of the Sky.